The following presentation was recorded at the Newbury Buddhist Monastery, Victoria, Australia. Please visit our website at nbm.org.au.
Good evening. My name is Ajahn Brahm, and today I have the privilege of saying a few words about meditation. And by meditation, I mean learning how to bring the body to a state of stillness and the mind to an even greater sense of stillness, and enjoying the beautiful peace and the power and the sense of clarity of mind which such states provide for you. And as you know, I've been a monk for so many years now, and I was meditating 5 years even before I became a monk. So it's over 50 years. And the meditation which you do is just some amazing experiences. And this is the main reason that I am a monk, simply because of stillness and the peace. All the other stuff which I do, to be honest, giving talks, funny talks, trying to help out, giving ordinations, which I did today to a wonderful bhikkhuni, all that is inspiring. But the core of what I do as a monk is, you know, to be really still and to help teach other people how to taste that stillness. And in order to experience that stillness, one of the little pieces of Dhamma I talked about today was something which the Buddha said, and we repeated this in the ordination ceremony, that when your mind is empowered with virtue, with a sense of restraint, with a sense of being good, being kind, not harming anybody, and settling business in the world rather than creating more business to be done. When one has that restraint, that empowers samadhi. And samadhi, the best translation I've ever had for that is stillness. So the first teaching in meditation is learning how to be restrained, to be good, to be kind. What it's actually doing is lessening the busyness of your mind. You don't have much to do. And that means you don't have much to think about, which means that the mind can very easily succumb to things like the present moment, to stillness, to peace. And it's not that you make that your business. Meditation is learning how to let go of all business, even the business of trying to be a good meditator. That is also a great mistake which people make. The stillness of meditation, as I understand it, as Ajahn Chah taught me, as I read in the suttas, is all about learning just how to basically to get out of the way, to renounce, to disappear, and let this beautiful stillness appear. Sometimes when people ask the question, how do you let go? Letting go is an important part of meditation, but how do you do that? And you can take something like learning how to be in the present moment. This is the place where your future is made. We can be free from all of the busyness of the past. Do you actually focus on the past and focus on the future and let them go? You find that that becomes very difficult. Instead, you can let go by choosing something which is far more valuable, far more attractive, far more pleasant. It's like the present moment. Being here right now is much more sense of freedom, spiritual power, meaning, than anything to do with the past or future. And when you know that, when you have trust in that, it's like the mind leaps towards the present moment and doesn't want much to do with the past or future. The present moment is valued much more. And that means you experience those other things vanishing, disappearing. It's the word viraga. They get less and less and less and disappear. And so it's not just with being in the present moment. It's also with this physical body of yours in meditation. You try to keep it as comfortable as you possibly can, but it's never comfortable. In other words, and the older you get, the more aches and pains there are to endure. You have sicknesses, you get cold or heat or whatever. So this body is a pain, it's an irritation. And so how can we let go of this body? You let it go by caring for it as much as you can until it gets reasonably relaxed. And then you focus on what happens when the body totally relaxes by going to the mind where you can't feel the body. And the mind leaps towards that too, of all the postures, positions of your body you can sit in. This is the most comfortable posture I'm ever in during the whole day. It's even more comfortable than lying down. I notice when I lie down, you're always moving this way, moving that way, turning. The position I go to sleep in is never the position where I wake up in the morning. You've moved, because even lying down is not as comfortable as finding a nice posture for meditation and letting the body disappear. You let it go by focusing on something which is obviously superior. And then one carries on like that throughout the whole part of the meditation. You leap towards, you know, things like, believe it or not, the breathing. You don't go looking for something like the breath comes to you. If you do anything, even just trying to look for the breath and holding the breath, you'll find you disturb the breath. Whatever you do, you tend to interfere with. So what happens is when you are meditating, you're in this present moment, you get into this wonderful thing called silence. Silence becomes so easy after a while, because who wants to trust in all these words and descriptions, all the names? You don't need to be a deep philosopher to realize that all the names we have for everything are only at the very best approximations. It's one of the reasons why I was inspired by poetry when I was young, because every now and again a poet could actually capture a phenomena so closely. They could capture it just with this combination of words used in a unique way. And it would describe something which would generate that experience back in my mind with my eyes closed. And it would be inspirational to see just how such power of words could get close. But that was the best lines of the best poets. But all the words which come into my head and all those thoughts which are built upon those one or two names, they just tend to miss the point. In the way of English, you think about things, about them. You never actually see into them. You never actually focus on the real thing, which is one of the reasons why that even intellectually, you prefer silence over any words or thoughts or comments or opinions. And in that silence is a great sense of freedom. That sense of freedom, you don't have to have an opinion about someone or something. In the silence, you're at peace. And that silence is something which I value so much. I don't let go of thinking. I just prefer the silence. I don't do anything. Just the mind leans towards that silence, inclines and leaps towards it. And that's, you know, precisely how it was said in the suttas by the Buddha. It said the mind, the word they used was pakandati. It leaps onto the silence. And not just the silence, but any other nice deep state of meditation. And so when the mind is silent and you're happy there, one thing, you don't need to take any notes when you're in that silence. You don't need to try and figure out what it all means. This is one training which I remember from the time I was a scientist. I was taught, when you are taking in the measurements, the data from the experiment, you note it down, but you don't think about it. You don't try and work out relationships between all those data you've collected until the end of the experiment. Once all the data is in, that's being collected, then you can figure out what it means, but not during the experiment. That's like meditation. All the experience which you can witness during the meditation, don't think what it means. Don't try and figure out Dhamma in the middle of your meditation. That should come at the very end. That's when you reflect what happened and what it meant. Otherwise, you spoil the meditation in the middle. Just get to that peace, that stillness, that lack of past and future, that silence. Have you noticed already all these states of meditation I've described, simple states, are all known by what's missing, what's lacking, not what's actually there? Say just no past, no future. That is present moment. No words, no discussion. That is silence. Not aware of your body. That's when you're in the mind. We know these things by what's vanished, what's disappeared. And that is how meditation works. We don't meditate. This is Ajahn Chah's saying, which I remember very clearly. You don't meditate to get things. You don't meditate to attain things. You meditate to experience things disappearing, to have less, not more, to see everything vanishing. And of course, this is what happens naturally. You get this beautiful silence. And then for me and for many others I've taught, it's natural. You soon become aware of your breathing. You don't choose to. It's the last thing which is moving in the body. You're breathing in and breathing out. And do you observe it? You've got no choice. It's the only thing left. And so you're experiencing it in this moment. And when you learn not to interfere with these things, it settles down all by itself. It becomes a natural process. You don't do anything. You are actually letting go. And you actually prefer even just the experience of the breathing, when you don't do it, it just happens, rather than you decide to watch the breath. One of the biggest problems with people who try to do meditation on the breath is when you try and do it. Don't do anything. You just sit there and the breath comes to you. You're mindful and you're kind, that's all. Of course, once that breath starts to come naturally, it's very pleasant, very beautiful. This is one of the parts about meditation which I often focus on because no one else does. At each stage of the meditation becomes more delightful, more beautiful. Even just relaxing the body, you feel a delight in the body. In present moment, the present moment is much more delightful than all the past and the future you bother your mind with. It's not that you're bothered by these things, you choose to bother yourself with these things. So you don't have to. That's why you can meditate instead. And all these words, after a while, you become comfortable not thinking. For many of you, if that's what you've been doing for so long, it's fearful to do something different. You're out of your comfort zone. Until you realize this is actually far more comfortable. And then when you're watching the breath, you realize you don't do it. The breath is just there. It becomes far more beautiful, far more natural, far more delightful, which is why the breath becomes so easy to watch. You're enjoying it. And as you're enjoying that experience of the breath more and more and more, that breath becomes softer, more beautiful, and it turns into these things we call nimittas. The beautiful lights come in the mind. You can't resist them. It's just what happens. It's not what you develop. It's just what happens when other things disappear. The experience of those nimittas is just how we call the experience of your mind. when the body is vanished and the five senses are settled and calmed down. And these beautiful nimittas, these lights in the mind, that's just how you interpret this thing called the mind. And as you interpret this thing called the mind, Ajita, then you actually find that it's great power, great joy, and you're having wonderful fun. Fun is not the right word. It's wonderful inspiration, insight, bliss with this meditation process, which means that the mind just loves to go there. The only thing which is a hindrance for most people is, again, they're not used to this or they're afraid of it. But please, have enough trust. And many of you have known me for so many years. This is just what happens. It's not a fact, well, I can do this, I can't do this. Everybody here can do this. It's not that you will do it, but you can. The only obstacles are what you place in front of your mind. It's not what's natural. If you let go and incline the mind to what's peaceful and beautiful and free, then you find these things just happen. And you go from the nimittas into jhana and have just the most wonderful time of your lives. Okay, I've taught the basics for 15 minutes, actually 17 minutes. So now we can actually do a guided meditation. I will begin by talking and guiding you through for about 15 or 16 minutes. And then towards the last part of the meditation, I will be quiet. Because I want you to actually to follow that momentum which I've given you to go deep into the mind and be really peaceful and joyful. And see just how much of what I said you can experience for yourselves. Okay, so here we go. If you do need to adjust your posture because you've been sitting a long time, please feel free to do that. We don't torture our body, we're kind to our body. And it's good to be able to close your eyes. Simply because once the eyes are closed, it's easy to have more restraint to the world of visual things. This meditation is being performed in the hall of the Sangha house in Newbury Buddhist Monastery. There's hardly any sound outside. So that's why it's pretty easy to close the ears metaphorically. But one of the hardest of senses to shut down in meditation is a sense of physical touch, a feeling of ache, pain, stress, or whatever in your body. So I invite you to follow this guided meditation through the body, first of all, as a means of increasing the power of your mindfulness and kindness, what I've called kindfulness, and at the same time as relaxing your body to a degree you maybe never experienced before. So I start, it doesn't matter how long I've been doing this, I start with my feet. To enable to contact those feet, to develop mindfulness, a connection between my brain and my feet, I do something very simple. I just ask the question, feet, how do you feel right now? Like I might ask you, now how are you today? And then you look and tell me some mindfulness, some information about your sense of comfort. When I ask my feet, I get an answer. And I can see I have a tiny bit of pressure on the ball of my left foot against the calf of my leg. Because I've being aware of my body and how it sits and the pressures. I know which ones are dangerous and which ones will disappear by themselves. And that's such a slight discomfort, I know it will disappear. So I don't need to adjust my posture. I let it be. But I'm still aware of my feet, that I can feel the soles of my feet, the heels, the uppers. I develop awareness. I'm not afraid of that awareness. And when I have that mindfulness of my feet, I add the kindness, and the feet relax. It's quite strange. I never thought you could do something like relaxing feet. You don't move them. You just allow the blood to just flow through them with more ease. And nothing is stretched or squashed. The whole feet kind of become loose, as if they've been soaking in a hot water bath. There's no pressure on them. It feels delightful. And I just imagine little metaphors like that, soaking in warm, hot water. I go past my feet to my ankles. Many people have trouble with their ankles, bruises, strains, sprains. I'm reasonably mindful of my body, so I don't tend to have so many accidents. Now I'm aware of my own ankles. Not just aware, but I add the kindness there. So I look upon these ankles with a sense of concern and care and friendliness. And one thing mindfulness supplies to you is what I call feedback. I can see my ankles, the feeling there changing, becomes more relaxed, more at ease. I'm doing a very deep form of letting go, not sort of holding these parts of my body tight, not controlling them. Letting them be loose and free and at ease, expanding. I'm not afraid. And I move up my legs, past the ankles, up the calves. I go slowly. I ask my calves and the bones inside, how are you? Skin, how do you feel? No way of getting more and more aware. The sensations in this part of my body. I'm giving them kindness, they too tend to relax. Now the lower half of my legs is more relaxed than they've probably been all day. I get to my knees. Many people have had injuries in their knees. I have fallen off ladders. I have played sports, fallen off motorbikes when I was young. I look at those knees and I give them kindfulness. I care for your knees. Sorry that I've not been careful enough for you in the past. And I feel those knees, a special fit sensation. I can recognize that's knee feeling. And I relax every part of my knees. It's the mindfulness gives me that feedback. I know when I'm relaxing and when I'm tightening up. And the feeling of relaxing, even your own knees, is very pleasant. You soon find out how to do it for yourself. So meditation teaches you skills. Bodily relaxation. And I go past my knees, up my thighs. Never have many problems in my thighs. But then I can feel them. Just scan slowly upwards, being kind and relaxing as I go up. Eventually I meet my buttocks. My butt is sitting on a cushion. There's pressure there. That is not so comfortable. The cushion is maybe not the best, but it's all I've got. So I leave it alone. I make sure that feeling of pressure of my butt against the cushion, those on a chair, the butt against the seat of the chair, is as even as possible. Because I know if it's even, then that too will soon disappear. Even though it's a very prominent feeling right now, I know when I move further up my body, that feeling will disappear, will not bother me again. To calm the body down, you don't need to get rid of feeling, just need to make peace with it. I go past my butt, I get to my waist. That is where I've got into the habit and my body appreciates it. I just stretch my back at this point and get this beautiful feelings of pleasure going, you know, to my waist and up my back. It's a forced feeling. But then once it's been stretched long enough, then I let go. When I let go of that doing, my back relaxes into a position which I can usually maintain for long periods of time with no discomfort. And I go back to the waist and to inside that waist, the bottom of the torso. And that's usually, for me anyway, dominated my digestive tract. Because the way that monks eat, that sometimes you have to be careful, otherwise you can get indigestion or sore in colon or sore intestines. So I just slowly scan my attention up my body. And if I do find any discomfort or any unusual feeling in my lower part of my torso as I scan up, I will pause there and give this extra piece of kindness, relaxation. So if I imagine that part of the body has been inflamed or squashed, put under some sort of tension, I imagine it being released, being freed. See if I can feel that sensation getting less intense. That's how I learned to relax my own digestive tract. And keep on scanning up until you get to your stomach. As you get to your stomach, again, the same thing, relaxing to the max. And keep scanning up till I get to my lungs, my heart, and any of those organs in your back. If you can feel anything which is slightly unusual, pause. And see if you can relax that area, feeling it becoming more loose and even and comfortable. Because I've done this for such a long time, I realized that what relaxes is actually kindness. That's what I learned what kindness really is. And eventually I get to my shoulders. When I get to my shoulders, I don't know why, but they always seem to be tense. And now I learn how to relax them. I imagine these two sheaves of muscles on either side of my spine. I imagine they're being pulled apart, stretched by these invisible demons. And I ask those two little monsters on either side of my spine, four in all, let go. No need to stretch anything or pull anything apart. Let go. Let those shoulder muscles be as natural as could be. Not squashed, not pulled, not stretched. My muscles now relax. I go down the arms. I usually go down my arms very quickly because they're usually always comfortable. But if you go past, say, your elbows and there's some discomfort there, please adjust your arms. Give some kindness to that part of the body and see if you can ease the problem. And I get to my hands. Often I put my hands in a position where the fingers are slightly touching, but not always. I'm not a prisoner of form. I ask my hands, how are you? And I follow their advice. The way my hands are now is not a usual position, but they're very comfortable. It's like I ask the question, the hand says, no, we're all right down here. So I can move on. And I go back to my shoulders and my neck. Sometimes you may be suffering from some sort of hay fever or cough. It's amazing that sometimes you can limit or alleviate that irritation in your throat just by being aware of it and knowing what kindness is. Kindness is not trying to get rid of irritations. Kindness is learning how to open the door of your heart no matter what you're feeling, and making peace with any irritations. Not curing them, but caring for them. It takes a longer while, but it's amazing what you can do to irritations in your own throat. But also I noticed that if your head is not correctly balanced on top of your neck, that can create so many headaches and other quite gross discomforts. So at this point, I just got into the habit over many years of moving my head to the left, to the right, forwards and backwards. And as I'm moving my head on top of my neck, I'm looking for the most comfortable position. And once I get to that comfortable position, then I know my head is well balanced. I don't need to move it again. And lastly, I go to my face. I just notice some muscles around my eyes and my mouth and my nose, say, especially maybe your head as well, your forehead. I notice if they're tight or if they're loose. And if they're tight, it's easy. I've learned from trial and error how to loosen those muscles around the eyes and the mouth to bring them to a state of relaxation. Because when I relax those muscles, I'm also easing any emotional tightness in my mind. So the face relaxes. And now I've relaxed so many parts of the body. I might have missed out a few, but these are the main ones for me. Now I Try and be aware of the whole body, like all those parts joined together. All relax. And I stay with this awareness of my whole body. This is what I do. It may not work for you, but I'm introducing it. Until I feel the body with an experience of delight. My body feels very pleasured. I use that word carefully. It is a pleasure with a relaxed body. Everything is at ease and loose. Because the reason I suggest this to you, because once I started to focus on the pleasure of bodily relaxation, I noticed that relaxation got even deeper. So really very amazingly relaxed, which is great for the health. It also means the body is ready to let go of, sorry, the mind is ready to let go of the body and get into some nice deep meditation. So first of all, to switch from the body awareness to the mind awareness. A lot of people don't understand what the mind is. So I ask people to notice how peaceful they are. Because peace doesn't live in the body, peace lives in your mind. It's one of the most significant and meaningful parts of your mind. So how peaceful are you now? You're looking at your mind now. How does the mind become more peaceful? You find the present moment is one of the best places. It's so much more free and enjoyable and meaningful to be in this moment rather than to keep on trawling through all that heavy weight of your past, or try and be afraid and try and guess what the future is going to be. The present is way more delightful than the past or the future, and more beneficial. You learn more from the present than you'll ever learn from the past. So I'm in the present now and enjoying it. Just like when the body gets relaxed as a delight, when your mind becomes relaxed, it feels more delightful. That's why the mind inclines towards the present. And soon, silence comes. Why try to describe this when you're enjoying it? No need to give things names. You don't need to take notes in your mind. Your mind will remember it by itself. Just in the silence, in the present moment. And sooner or later you'll find you become aware of your breathing. It's the main thing which is moving in your mind and body. You don't have to force long breath or short breath or whatever. This is a natural progression, not what you do, but what you experience. Because the body is relaxed, the mind is relaxed. You don't need much breath. Just one breath, one moment in silence. Enjoy it to the max. You really are in the moment, enjoying this breath. The limiters are very close. I will be quiet now. Allow you to enjoy whatever happens next. It's now becoming close to the end of this meditation. Don't open your eyes yet. How peaceful are you inside? When the mind is still, how delightful is it? How satisfying. When the mind is still, how does your body feel? And the body feels really healthy due to the stillness of the mind. This is where we get the best insight from the experience of peace and stillness. Now I will ring the gong 3 times. When the gong finishes sounding for the 3rd time, that signals the end of the meditation period. Now, once the meditation is complete, we have the opportunities for questions and answers, what we call Dhamma Sakaccha, not just listening to Dhamma, listening to talks, being able to probe and ask some questions. They're usually those in the hall, hopefully being quiet enough. It takes a while for the mind to be able to formulate a question. But nevertheless, anybody in the hall here, live audience, have a question they'd like to ask? If not, we have the people listening online. So will our MC please let us know?
Thank you very much, Ajahn. There are a few questions already. The first one is from Abante, who asks, Master, can you say anything about the teachers of Chan or Zen meditation, specifically such meditation methods as koans or hua tuo? My apologies for mispronunciation. It's Huatou, where there is a strong emphasis on the cultivation of doubt.
It's doubt is, for me, a negative state of mind. Either clarity can also be a delusive state of mind, but peace is something which is free of doubt. It's a beautiful thing to just know when the mind is still, when you're peaceful, when the mind stops that thinking, but the knowing gets energized and very clear, then there's no doubt there at all. Instead, the mind is poised. And it's from that poise that one gets into those very deep states of mind. doubt may be used to get rid of, to sweep the path into deep meditations. But you can't take that doubt into the meditation. Basically, in the deep meditations, there's no doubt at all. Doubt is part of the five hindrances. And those five hindrances are suppressed within the deep meditations. Hopefully I got that question correct. So anyway, that's my answer so far.
Thank you, Ajahn. Actually, there was a follow-up below later in the chat, which I didn't see. It was just clarifying the koan method, such as asking, what is this, repeatedly. I don't know if that clarifies the question at all.
Not really, because after a while, any question which is repeated and repeated, if it stops all questions and allows you to have silence, that is better.
Okay, thank you, Ajahn. Next question is, how did Ajahn first understand what mindfulness is and finally get rid of thought about past and future in meditation? Kindly give insight about being present, even if the present is not pleasant.
The present is always more pleasant than anything else, especially if you give loving kindness to this present moment. The problem, the difficulty with some people is they're not really focused in the present. They're not really knowing what it is, and they're smeared into the future or the past. In the past, we have been sometimes conditioned to believe that we have to deal with things of the past to settle them. Otherwise, they will always be bothering us. But the insights, which I know, are that you can let go of the past, even some terrible stuff in the past. You don't have to associate your identity and own those things in the past. When there's no ownership, of course it's letting go. It happens with the past. And with the future, is totally uncertain. It's work in progress. You can always adapt or change to the future. And the most important thing is your reaction to the future. So really, the present moment can always be very pleasant. You're happy to be here. But just that happiness to be here gives you the sense of freedom. You don't have to get rid of anything. You don't have to escape from anything. You're right here. So really, if the present moment you interpret it as unpleasant, I think you can change your interpretations.
Thank you, Ajahn. Our third question is, I experience the same thing like unpleasant smells at about the same hour every day. How to overcome when the mind repeats itself, or is it obsession with ill will?
It could be obsession with ill will. It reminded me of that story when people on retreats, when there's always somebody who is noisy, who snores or who makes noises or their tummy rumbles. And Ajahn Chah would always say, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. In other words, this is noise exists and you can't control it. Same with smells. Sometimes it's beautiful smells, sometimes it's unpleasant smells. And you can't do much about this. So please don't disturb the smells. They're part of nature. And if you don't give them much importance, of course, after a while, the mind doesn't get interested in them. And they disappear by themselves. But if it's the same unpleasant smell comes often, I'm just really wondering whether that's a sign of, like, as we know in Buddhism, well, we believe we know in Buddhism, but sometimes some deceased spirits or unpleasant beings, or not so unpleasant beings, beings born in unpleasant states. If you are meditating, a really good person, sometimes those beings may come to, you know, almost try and ask for some sort of help. I'm not sure that is possible for the person asking the question, but that's something I would explore. There's someone in your family who's died recently, or you're in a place or a position in the world where there's been some sort of tragedy. If ever that happens, just out of kindness, it's nice to give some loving kindness, and just in case, to a being who may be exhibiting their presence by a bad smell because they're in an unpleasant situation. Maybe try that. But otherwise, the unpleasant smells, they just disappear. Try another question.
Thank you, Ajahn. There are more questions. The next one is, hi, Ajahn. How do I stop projecting the worst case scenario around a situation my son has got himself into? Even in meditation, I get flashes of fear. Thank you.
Okay, remember, just flashes of fear don't solve any problems. They just make your reaction worse. So realizing just it's a bad habit you've gotten into, obviously, because it's your son, something very close to you. But look, if you're a very good practitioner, please know it's not your son. You don't own them. They're a being who's come into your life this time around. And you're doing your very best to care for them, but don't overcare. And I say that because sometimes that people, they want to love their children, they want to love their friends, but they go too far. In other words, they'd almost like smother their children. Remember, your children have to learn by their own mistakes and to experience the fruits of their karma. Very similar to the fact that these days people just don't allow their children just to, you know, fall in the dirt, to get bruised or cut, and to actually develop their natural immunity to such things when they're young. Just, I remember just what I did to my body when I was young and my mother saw it. She would just quickly wash it up, not disinfect anything. And that kind of gave you a natural immunity and toughness. Yes, she was my mother. Yes, she loved me, but she didn't sort of mollycoddle me, if you understand that word. So she allowed me to get sick. She allowed me to have an infection or something. And that made my body stronger for it. You learned from your mistakes. So whatever you're afraid of with your son, sometimes it's an over-exaggeration. We love to exaggerate, which is weird. I think the reason why we love to exaggerate is because this gives us something to do and something to think about. A lot of times people don't appreciate things like silence and peace and harmony. And we start thinking about, again, the negative things which happen in this world. You may have known that story which I told again just a few days ago. Actually, the first day I came here on the Waysak day, about the two bad bricks in the wall. I just was wondering, why do most human beings, especially me at that time, because I told the story, why do I keep obsessing about my mistakes? Why do you keep thinking about all the bad things which might go wrong instead of the more likely things which can go right? And it's like a negative attitude which we have been conditioned with over so many years. I think part of that might be what you see in news broadcasts on the internet or wherever. I remember years ago when I was young, I really did think there'll be a nuclear war. I honestly thought there'd be a nuclear war between Soviet Union and the United States. It was obviously, it had to happen, I thought. Of course, it never did. And many other people were trying to encourage that idea simply because it gave them sort of something which other people would listen to. It gave them some sort of importance. Good news is always boring for many people. and want to be excited. Basically, you want to disturb your own meditation. It's a tough thing to say, but there's a lot of truth to that. Okay, the next question.
Thank you, Ajahn. Next question is, hi Ajahn, I find I spend most of my meditation just relaxing different parts of the body, and the meditation time is nearing the end when I get to the mind. Any advice?
You just meditate for longer. In other words, it's unfortunate that I have a time here, a schedule, just to meditate for 45 minutes. And sometimes I prefer it if it's natural, you can just keep going. And if your body gets very, very relaxed, then of course, you can meditate for long periods of time, a couple of hours. So if that's the case, if that always happens, then see if you can get your machine to turn off the sound after the 45 minutes and just carry on and see how deep you can become. Can get. It's one of the reasons why these guided meditations or taught meditation, they're not that natural. But at least it teaches you just how to relax the body. Maybe that body relaxation gets quicker after a while when you get more skilled at it. And also you can learn how to have some more time to meditate. It's great fun. On retreats, which I teach, of course, because we own the retreat center, just people keep on going. And sometimes they miss their breakfast or they miss their lunch because they're just happily meditating there. They don't want to come out of meditation. Have a wonderful time. Okay, next question.
Thank you, Ajahn. The next person is asking for some help. They write, thank you for the talk and for hosting my precept ceremony several years ago. Since then, my mother, who was my last family, passed away. And since then, I've been in a chronic state of panic, anxiety, and grief. The current state of affairs in the world certainly has not helped. I'm so tired of living this way. What words do you have for me?
To make sure when you look at this world, you look more at the 998 million good bricks rather than the two bad bricks. Sometimes it's incredible, beautiful things happening in this world. Just even today, we did a bhikkhuni ordination here at Newbury Buddhist Monastery. We're bringing back that part of the Sangha, the Buddhist Sangha, which had been disappeared, oppressed for so many centuries, and it's coming alive again, and it's working, and that's really inspirational. There's incredibly good things happening in this world. And when you see those beautiful things happening in this world, that gives you this energy to solve even more problems which may have been existing in this world. And that means you just do never get anxious. These amazing things happen. Anxiety just makes bad things happen. But when you have a beautiful mind, you do some more meditation, you come on these retreats, you witness things like ordination ceremonies. Look, even more impressive, please, sorry, Bhikkhuni Santa who ordained today. But even more impressive for me, there was a novice ordination, a Samanera ordination over in Bodhinyana Monastery in the West. And this young man, or middle-aged man, he'd been trying for such a long time to take that ordination. And when he was being ordained, when I was giving him the precepts, he wasn't crying, he was weeping with joy. And that was just a really moving thing that somebody was appreciating the power of like going forth, of joining the Sangha. That was really amazing. That gives you so much inspiration in this world. There's many bad things happening in this world, but there's amazingly good things happening as well. Never allow the weeds which are growing in the garden to stop you enjoying the flowers which are growing there as well. Another question?
Thank you, Ajahn. Yes, next question is, will we always experience nimittas if we use anapanasati?
Eventually you will. So nimittas are just what happens. The more you let go, the more the body, five senses vanish. When the five senses vanish, you're just left with the sixth sense. And that's how most people experience that sixth sense. It's a beautiful light in the mind. And a lot of people experience those nimittas, but they don't allow them to stay very long. So just like a flashing light or a very dull light. But eventually, when you know what you're doing and talking about, you can develop those just by letting them alone and letting them grow by themselves. It's not just anapanasati either. Other types of meditation, like metta meditation, or you know, you call maitri, that develops a beautiful golden light, a golden limiter. It's gorgeous. So there's many types of meditation. This is just what happens just when the five senses are quietened down and the sixth sense starts to get all the power.
Thank you, Ajahn. Our next question is, thank you so much for your and the other monks' service on YouTube. It is wonderful to have found you all. My question, I meditate and I'm learning more about Buddhism. When does a person call themselves a Buddhist, or does it not matter?
Yes, many people ask that question. Personally, when I was still a student, there came a time when this made so much sense to me. I discovered it. I liked it. I started practicing it. And I thought, well, why not sort of be honest and be truthful? I was a boy, so I went in the boys' toilets. I was young, so I knew exactly where you stood in the pecking order of life. And also, you realize I was a Buddhist. Why not just be honest and just say that this is your inclination? The nice thing about being a Buddhist, it's not like some other religions. Once you say you remember that religion, you have to be that forever, for the whole life. As a Buddhist, if you feel you're a Buddhist, then say you are. And if you decide you need to do something else later on in your life, that's fine too. You have this wonderful sense of freedom and peace. And then after a while, you find that you're a Buddhist and that's it. And you understand this, for myself anyway, there's no way you're ever going to do anything else. So this is just being honest to how you feel about yourself. Anyway, who is a Buddhist anyway? It's not your body being a Buddhist. It's about just the inclination of your mind, your spiritual journey. It's got a name, and many millions and billions of people have followed that same journey. So this is actually what Buddhism is. Describes your spiritual path.
Thank you, Ajahn. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
I'm okay. What about you? It's 8:52. I'm happy, yes.
Thank you, Ajahn. The next question is, in one of your books, I've read that one with deep stillness can look into their own past lives. But I've read that the Buddha has looked into other people's past lives. Can you please explain?
I think the Buddha looking into other people's past lives can only be done, and even saying this very carefully, even with the Buddha, by where other people's past lives have coincided with his past life. In other words, he's just remembering those people from his own past lives. Good example of that is, I'm not quite sure if you know that one of the Buddha's past lives, which he mentioned, this is recorded in the suttas, was this man called Jyotipala, and his friend was Gatikara, and this was in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. And when the Buddha was recalling a previous life, it's in this eon, so it must be not that far ago, that Jyotipala ordained as a bhikkhu under Bhikkhu Kassapa, under the Buddha Kassapa, sorry. So this is, the Buddha Kassapa was a previous Buddha to Siddhartha Gautama. And our Buddha now was a monk, a disciple of the previous Buddha. And he remembered his past lives, his own past lives. So did the Buddha Siddhartha Gautama discover, invent the Four Noble Truths? Or did he remember listening to them from the Buddha Kassapa? That's me asking a question.
I don't have the answer for that one, Ajahn.
When you have questions, you don't need answers. The questions just lead you onto a very interesting path of inquiry. So anyway, another question?
Thank you, Ajahn. How do we use Buddha Anusati and Metta concentration?
It's how to use Buddha Anusati. Some years ago, when I was in Singapore, I was asked to go to this young, it was a kindergarten called, I think, Little Gems, I think they were called it. And sometimes, and I'm maybe overconfident, and I never asked exactly what is this kindergarten. And it was really young kids, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds. And they wanted me to teach them about Waisak. How do you teach young kids about Waisak? You don't start by teaching them the Four Noble Truths. That's way beyond their intellectual capacity. So instead, I said Waisak stands for the birth of the Buddha, the enlightenment of the Buddha, and his final passing away. And many of them had seen the images. So according to our tradition, that when the Buddha was born, he took 7 steps and put up a finger and said, this is my last life and I'm the chief in this world. So I got all the kids to do that, to walk slowly. And then at the 7th step, said, oh, this is my last life, I'm number one in the world. And they liked doing that because it was active. And the next thing was meditate. I said, oh, you've seen the Buddha statues, crossed legs, back straight, meditated. So they all did that. And then I just did something really wonderful because everybody in the room, including the teachers and the parents, were also doing this. Now imagine you are the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. You've just become enlightened. Imagine how that feels. You've got nothing more to achieve in this world, nothing at all to fear. Everything has been done. You'll never feel any pain or disappointment anymore. You're totally free, at peace, still, safe. I went on like this, and all the parents were blissing out so much because they were actually not just saying words, they were experiencing what we call a taste of enlightenment, real freedom. And they liked it so much, they asked me to do it again for everybody else that evening. The wonderful meditation. That is Buddha Anusati. Imagine what it must be like to be fully enlightened. You've heard so many descriptions of it. Now just imagine some of those. And that just makes you just really bliss out, become really still. And so that's how you can use Buddha Anusati. And what was the other one? The metta.
Concentration.
Yes. And again, please excuse me, but concentration is not a good translation of the word samadhi. It doesn't mean that at all. And it's also in the West that gives very bad connotations. Concentration camps. And I'm sorry, but I remember my teachers would say, concentrate, concentrate, when I was a small kid. That made me afraid. And so concentration is not really that good a term. Stillness is a much better rendition of that term. I remember this Chinese professor from Stanford would come to meditate at jhana grove for a while. And when I mentioned anyone in my talk, she came back and gave me all the sources why that samadhi does mean stillness, not concentration at all, in the Chinese translations of the suttas. So loving kindness, metta, stillness. Of course that leads to beautiful nimittas, to deep states of disappearing from the world and great insights. Okay, it's 8:59. Do you want another question or have you had enough?
The people online have not quite had enough of you yet, Ajahn. Could we squeeze one more question in?
Certainly.
We'll make it a very a short one. What is Saddharma?
Saddharma means usually good Dhamma, with the Dhamma. What is the context? Because one thing which I learned when I learned Pali, you can't just translate a word without knowing its context. The unit of language is a phrase, not a word.
All right. Unfortunately, the person has provided no context for that. So given that it's now 9 o'clock, we may just thank you, Ajahn, for your guided meditation tonight and your wisdom and finish there.
Okay. Do we usually do a chant?
Okay.
We'll do sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Arahant.
Just do it. What do we normally do?
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, thank you all for listening.